4. The Will of the Gods. A battered, barren world circled a blue-white spark of fusion fire. This world had seen the rise and fall of nation after nation, from simple provincial states to planetary confederations to interstellar empires and galactic republics. It had been the scene of a million battles, from simple surface skirmishes to the destruction of whole civilizations. It had been ravaged by war and reconstruction until its original environment survived only beneath sterile polar ice caps. It was the most artificial world of a galactic culture devoted to artifice. The whole planet had become a machine. This was about to change. Its new masters began by stealing its moons. Stripped from orbit by Dovin-Basel gravity drives, the three smaller moons were steered well away, while the largest was pulverized by tidal stress created by pulses from other Yamask-linked Dovin-Basels. A refined application of similar techniques organized the resultant mass of dust and gravel and lumps of hardening magma into a thick, spreading ring disk of rubble that rotated around the planet at an angle 17 degrees from the ecliptic. This, while dramatic in itself, was only a prologue. Dovin-Basels had been grown on the planet's surface. The effect of gravity can be profitably described topographically as an altered curvature of space-time. The Dovin-Basels on the planet's surface altered the curve of local space-time in such a way that the direction of the planet's orbit became, roughly speaking, uphill. The planet slowed. Slowing, it fell inward, toward its sun. It got warmer. On its long, slow fall toward its sun, the planet suffered a bombardment of small meteors. Carefully sized, and with their angle of atmospheric entry precisely calculated so that they would reach an average temperature sufficient to vaporize their primary mineral, without cracking it into its constituent molecules of hydrogen and oxygen. The primary mineral of these small meteors was a mineral only in the black chill of interplanetary space. By the time it reached the warming surface, it had lost its crystalline structure and was simply water. For the first time in 1,000 years, natural rain fell across the face of the planet. Once the planet had spiraled into its revised orbit, the Dovin-Basels quieted, and space returned to its customary topography. The three remaining moons were moved back into new, more complex orbits, whose tidal effects would eventually braid the striated disk of rubble that ringed the planet into a permanent sky bridge of rainbow lace. By the time the seed ship fell back into normal space and moved toward an orbital intercept, the planet duplicated, in its gross elements of orbital length, rotation, moons, and rings, the eon-lost homeworld of the Yuuzhan Vong. It remained only to remake the surface and bring life to the shattered remnants of what once had been a single planet-wide city, so that the planet could grow into the name it would bear, Yuuzhan-Tar, the Creche of God. Coruscant was ready for seedfall. In the nursery, it was the Teazopil Yunshalat, the day of comprehending the will of the gods. In these last few hours before seedfall, teams of shapers fanned out through the Duryam's domains, measuring, calculating, indexing, and evaluating. Each shaper team walked in company with a squad of towering, lanky warriors, heavily armored, weapons at the ready, glittering eyes scanning ceaselessly, moving with the ponderously sinister threat of reeks in mating season. Four squads guarded the Shriyamtes, a small, specialized subspecies of Yamask. This speeder-sized creature existed only to emit a powerful interference signal in the telepathic band used by Yamasks and Duryams alike. The squads had carried the barrel-bodied Shriyamtes into the nursery in a huge basin filled with nutrient fluid. This was the first act of the Teazopil Yunshalat, because each Duryam knew that this was the day that would decide life or death. The Shriyamtes ensured that none of the Duryams could use its slaves for any desperate act of sabotage or self-defense. These slave seeds are designed with a failsafe. When telepathic contact with a Duryam is severed, each slave seed automatically immobilizes its slave by driving him mercilessly toward its parent, the coral tree basil from which slave coral was harvested. Shrieking sudden, inexplicable agony, the slaves scrambled for each domain's coral tree basil. Only actual physical contact with the coral tree basil could quiet a slave's pain. Even the sick and wounded had dragged themselves over rocks and through swamps, howling. This organized the slaves into neat little clusters, keeping them safely out of the way until they could be most conveniently disposed of. To the slaves, it didn't matter which Duryam won. None of them were supposed to live long enough to find out. Numanor glared at the image in the view spider's sack of optical jelly. "Why doesn't he do something?" Rajer shrugged liquidly and leaned to one side to get a better look through the view spider's thicket of legs. "He is doing something, just not what you expected. He knows, doesn't he? He knows the slaves are to be killed. He knows." The image in the optical jelly was barely more than a shadow in a twilight mist. The Shriamtees blocked the view spider's image links along with the Duryam's control. To maintain its view of Jason Solo, it was forced to generate a shadow shape using the infrared-sensitive eye spots of the sessile polyps in the amphistaff grove. "He just stands there," Numanor growled. He shifted his weight, glowering at the image. "How can he simply stand? The agony. Agony, yes. Suffering? Perhaps. He has learned much. Is he hiding? Is that it?" Berger shrugged again. "If so, he has picked the perfect spot." The shadow of Jason Solo stood at the heart of the amphistaff grove. "And the polyps don't attack," Numanor muttered, gnawing absently on the edge of one knuckle. "They have slashed and slaughtered everyone within their reach for weeks, slave, warrior, and shaper alike. But this Solo, he's like one of those, what do you call them, trigger birds, that sail along in perfect safety within the feeding tentacles of a Bespinese beldon. Perhaps he and the polyps have reached some understanding? I do not find the prospect reassuring." "No? You should, Executor. It is for this that I have trained him, yes?" Numanor pulled his knuckle away from his mouth and squinted at her. "For this? Of course. Here, now, at the crisis point, at the day of decision, Jason Solo does not stand with others of his kind. Despite the worst pain his nervous system can suffer, he has chosen to stand among the life forms of an alien galaxy. Our galaxy, Executor. He has more in common with the masters than he does with the slaves. And he begins to recognize this. Are you sure? He may have journeyed so far along the true way already that the fate of slaves no longer concerns him." "I don't believe it," Numanor growled. "I don't believe it for a nanoblip." "You don't know these Jedi as I do. Perhaps not." Rajer's crest fanned a faintly self-amused green. "Does anyone?" Abruptly, Numanor reached into a head-sized bubble den in the wall near his knee and grabbed a villip. "There is a slave in the amphistaff grove," he said into it. "Pick him up. Bind him and return him to my coral craft." The villip whispered with the reply from the commander of Numanor's Uglith-masked warriors. "I hear and obey, Executor." "As you value your father's bones, do not fail in this. This slave is a Jedi infiltrator who must not be allowed to disrupt the Teezopil Yunchalat." "If he resists, I would prefer that he lives. But I do not require it. Do not risk damage to the seed ship. Minimize any disruption." "I hear and obey, Executor." Numanor commanded the villip to revert to its original form. "So," he turned again to Verger, "as you say, our Solo project has progressed well. The nursery has served its purpose. We'd have to remove him before the executions anyway. Better to get it taken care of now, in case he still harbors any illusions of heroism. The ceremony must continue without any risk of interference. You should be planning the next phase of his training. You'll want to continue as soon as he's safely aboard my coral craft.
My people, Numanor, Rhaegar said meditatively, have a proverb about counting glitter flies when all one has is maggots.
What? Numanor scowled. What does that mean?
I believe, she nodded toward the viewspider's image sack, that you are about to find out.
Jason stands in the amphistaff grove, watching. The slave seed shrieks flame through every nerve in his body, sizzling commands for him to run, to scramble and sprint for the coral tree basil only 30 meters away. He burns in this fire, but is not consumed. The fire is an alembic that has distilled everything he is, has ever been, ever will be, into one eternal instant. Like the white before it, the fire has washed away time. All of Jason's time has become one single now, and the fire inside him feeds his strength. Out of the shadows, out in the blue-white glare of the nursery's constant noon, four slaves suddenly step away from the nearest coral tree basil, letting its fronds drop from their hands. They do this casually, efficiently, without haste, but with no wasted motion, and they glance toward the amphistaff grove, toward the deep shade where Jason stands. They don't seem to be in pain. This, Jason knows already, is because they're not really slaves. He wonders fleetingly if Anakin had felt this way. Calm. Ready. Looking at the price he was about to pay and deciding he'd gotten a bargain. Out in the blue-white noon, the four slaves press the sides of their noses and the Ooglith maskers they had worn peel apart, filaments unthreading from pores to leave smeared beads of blood like sweat. The maskers ripple and flow down the revealed warriors, then squirm away to vanish in the grass. The warriors walk toward the amphistaff grove. Jason closes his eyes, and for one second he is among his family. His father's hand ruffles his hair. His mother's arm is warm around his shoulders. Jaina and Loey groan in MTD, makes a sarcastic comment as Jason tries one more time to tell a joke to Tenel Ka. But Chewbacca is not there. Neither is Anakin. The four warriors stop just beyond the fringe of the grove. Juvenile amphistaffs whip the air threateningly, and the polyps' ground mouths gape wide, mutely anticipating a rain of blood and flesh. One warrior calls out in harsh guttural basic, "Jedi slave, come out!" Jason's only response is to open his eyes. "Jedi slave, come out from there!" They wear no armor. The only Von Doon crabs within reach are the wild ones that infest the bog beyond the coral tree basil, coming out at night to feed on the polyps at the edges of the grove. Unarmored warriors could not survive even seconds within the hissing swirl of juvenile amphistaffs. Jason adjusts his stance, organizing his thoughts and his breathing into a Jedi meditation that reaches deep within himself, beyond the searing pain from the slave seed, into memories of what he has learned through his mental link with the Duryam. Memories so vivid, they are like a waking dream. Now the fully armed warriors who guard the Shriamtes are taking notice. Some begin to move deliberately toward the amphistaff grove, and the warriors who ring the hive pond shift uneasily and adjust their weapons. "Jedi slave, if we must come in, it will go worse for you." Jason is deep in the meditation now. He can feel the thrum of emotive hormones through the rudimentary brains of the amphistaff polyps around him. He can taste their blood hunger like a mouthful of raw meat. The warrior turns and barks a command in the tongue of the Yuuzhan Vong. Two more false slaves step away from a coral tree basil and allow their Ooglith maskers to slither down their legs. The newly revealed warriors grab a real slave. One holds him while the other crushes the slave's throat with a knife-hand strike. They step back and let the slave fall, watching dispassionately while he writhes in the dirt, choking to death.
"Jedi slave, come out, or another will die. Then another and another, until finally only you are left. Save their lives, Jedi. Come out."
Now Jason's waking meditation dream interpenetrates with the memory of another dream, a real dream, a forest dream so vivid he can still smell the coral skipper buds, can still see the scarified faces of the warrior guards and the coral-maimed bodies of the slaves, a dream he had 2 years ago on Belkaten, a dream in which he freed slaves of the Yuuzhan Vong. How astonished he felt, how bereft, when that dream did not come true, when his attempt to fulfill its promise ended in disaster, in blood and death and torture. He felt as though the Force itself had betrayed him. Now he sees that he had not been betrayed. He'd merely been impatient.
Jedi slave, come out!
Jason sighs and surfaces from the meditation. All right, he says quietly, a little sadly. If you insist. His still shadow becomes a shade in motion, drifting noiselessly through the grove of blood-hungry polyps. He stops at the penumbra bordering the blue-white noon beyond. The amphistaffs whirl lethal halos at his back.
Here I am.
Farther, the warrior commands. Move beyond the reach of the grove.
Jason opens his empty hands. Make me. The warrior turns his head fractionally toward his companions.
Kill another.
You, Jason says, are no warrior. The warrior's three companions jabber excitedly among themselves. The leader's head snaps around as though yanked by a tractor beam.
What?
Warriors win battles without murdering the weak.
Jason's voice drips acid contempt. Like all Yuuzhan Vong, you make war only upon the helpless. You are a coward from the species of cowards.
The warrior stalks forward. His eyes glitter a crazed, feral yellow.
You call me coward? You? You simpering Jedi brat? You shivering brenslet cowering in the shadow of your den? You slave?
This Jedi brenslet slave, Jason says distinctly, clinically, spits upon your grandfather's bones. The warrior lunges, taloned fingers reaching to tear the eyes from Jason's face. With an exhausted sigh, Jason collapses before the warrior's rush, falling to his back, while lightly taking the warrior's outstretched wrists and planting one foot in the pit of the warrior's stomach to make a fulcrum. Jason rolls, kicking upward, and the warrior flails helplessly as he flips through the air into the blade storm of the amphistaffs. Jason lies for a moment in the sudden rain of Yuuzhan Vong blood and gobbets of warrior flesh. He turns his head to watch the juvenile amphistaffs rake chunks of the warrior's corpse toward the salivating gape of the polyp's ground mouths. Then he rises. He faces the remaining three.
Well?
They exchange uncertain glances. At Jason's back, the polyps slurp and gurgle, and the amphistaffs whirl hungrily. The warriors stand their ground, calling out in their own tongue. In answer to their call, two of the squads who guard the Shriyamtis lumber heavily forward, bearing amphistaffs of their own, bandoliers of thud-bugs and other less familiar weapons, and wearing full Von Dune crab armor. The shell of a Von Dune crab can stop a lightsaber. It can resist even the atomic diameter edge of an amphistaff blade. One of the three nearby shows Jason his teeth, long and needle-sharp, curving inward like a predator's.
"Not to keen, Jedi. Here's that, Sir Trismek Schmack," he spits. "Tyrok Jan Trismek, Jedi."
Jason doesn't need to speak their tongue to understand. No trick of wrestling will help a lone unarmed man against two squads of warriors, Jedi or not. The warrior is advising him to prepare to die. Jason smiles. It's a sad smile, melancholy, resigned. He nods. In a part of his mind far from the pain and the blood and the harsh blue-white glare, he can feel the dark satisfaction of the amphistaff polyps behind him as they swiftly, almost instantly, digest the fallen warrior. He feels their glittering anticipation and the shuddering release as they use the meal of warrior's flesh to give themselves the strength to reproduce. Amphistaff polyps breed asexually. The amphistaphs themselves become a polyp's offspring, released from their nodules to squirm away in search of the proper ground to take root and begin their transformation into polyps themselves. Through this empathic connection, Jason shows them the ground he recommends. Trusting their friend, the amphistaphs take his advice. He stretches forth his arms. The warriors can only stare in open-mouthed awe as amphistaphs fall like leaves from the polyps at his back. As amphistaphs wriggle down the polyps' knobby leathern trunks and slither through the grass. Amphistaphs twine about Jason's ankles and climb his body like vines enveloping a forgotten jungle idol. They twist around his legs, his hips, his chest, coiling the length of his arms, shrouding his neck, curving up to embrace even his skull. The approaching squads of fully armed warriors slow uncertainly, not quite sure, now, how to attack. Because the Von Doon crab is not the only creature that can resist the cut of an amphistaph blade. Jason brings his hands together before him and offers the warriors a solemn bow. When he parts his hands again, a mature amphistaph stretches between them, blade and spike, fully envenomed, as is every one of the 17 amphistaphs that make up his armor. Jason says, "I'd like you all to meet some friends of mine." Numenor hurled his sackworm across the chamber. It splattered against the wall, then slid to the floor, where it gave out a tiny whistling sigh and died. Instantly, Numenor mastered himself again, wiping his lipless mouth with the back of his wrist. "So it is over," he muttered darkly. "We have failed. You have failed," he amended, wondering if he could get far enough away in his coral craft to escape Savang La's anger at this new disaster. Wondering if he could give himself up to the New Republic, if there was any way he could persuade the surviving Jedi not to slay him on sight. He still knew many secrets, valuable secrets. Vergere interrupted his speculation. "Executor, let me go to him." "Absolutely not. I can't have you running around in the middle of the Teezok Pil Yunchalat, you foolish creature. Don't you remember that our solo project is secret? How secret will it be after you run through the nursery trying to save his useless skin?" "Hardly useless, Executor. As I said before, his education has proceeded very well indeed, though I admit it could be going better right now."
"Could be better?"
Numenor flicked his wrist at the view spider's optical sac, where the dim silhouette of Jason Solo armed himself.
"He has learned nothing. He is about to throw his life away in a futile battle over mere slaves. He is as weak as any other Jedi. Weaker.
He is not a Jedi," Vergere replied imperturbably. "And it is not his life that concerns me."
"Are you mad?"
Numenor stomped furiously around the view spider, which danced nervously to keep its delicate feet out from under the Executor's human-style boots.
"He cannot possibly win such a battle. How can he expect to fight two squads? Even if he goes back to hiding in the grove,
winning," Vergere said, her crest fanning a solemn blaster boar gray, "is not the same as fighting. Watch." The shadow suddenly vanished, and the image within the optical sac shifted and flickered liquidly as the view spider sought new visual sources.
"What's happening?"
Numenor demanded uselessly.
"Does he flee? Is he running away like the broken Jedi brat he has always been,
Executor?" Her fingers wrapped his elbow astonishingly strong. "Jason Solo no longer has the Force, but that is not his only weapon. He is a warrior born, eldest son and heir to a long line of warriors. He has trained since birth in the combat arts. He has been tested and tried, bloodied in battle, and
he's nothing but a boy."
Numenor stared at her.
"Have you lost your wits? I know this boy. Humans do not honor warrior lineage. He means nothing. He is nothing."
Vergere spoke without the faintest hint of irony. "I tell you this. though neither he nor they yet know it. He is the greatest of all the Jedi. Jason Solo is the living Jedi dream. Even without the Force, he is more dangerous than you can possibly imagine. You must let me go to him. He must be stopped.
Stopped? From what? Soiling his robe skin as he runs away?
Stopped from destroying the Teezopil Yunchalot. Stopped very likely from destroying the seed ship itself.
Numenor's mouth came open, but from it came only a fading hiss. The calm certainty in Vergere's eye silenced him as effectively as a punch in the throat. He couldn't seem to get his breath.
"Destroy the ship?" he was finally able to gasp. "Don't you understand, Executor? He isn't running away."
She gestured at the viewspider's sack, where it had recovered enough image to show a lone shape sprinting headlong to meet the oncoming thunderclouds of warrior squads. Vergere said,
"He's attacking."